Well, good morning, everybody. Everybody's doing all right this morning. We had a great weekend last weekend. I think you probably heard part of this last week if you were here, but it was the first week that we launched our North Raleigh campus out there, and they called it a soft launch because they were trying to get their just leadership teams together, and they had a full service in not one but two different services out there at that North Raleigh campus. So something to thank God for. So for you guys that are joining us at North Raleigh, as well those of you at the rest of our campuses, we are grateful that all of you guys are with us today. There are always a lot of different things that are going on here at the Summit Church that are important, and you always find those in your worship guide. Every once in a while, I find it necessary to comment and make any little cheap shots on one or another of them. And the one that I want to talk about just for a second is Frontline. Now, Frontline is not a heart medicine for your dog. I know some of you think that. Frontline is what we use to try to get people off of the sidelines in our church and into the front lines of ministry. And by front lines of ministry, I'm only referring right now to what happens here on the weekend. I realize there's a lot bigger and more important things that happen throughout the week in the community and ministry. But as far as on Sunday morning, helping us to be the church that really ministers to the community, it takes a lot to pull off what happens here. We have a little phrase we use around here, and that is that the sermon starts in the parking lot, meaning that when somebody new comes, it's not just what I say to them that often is what brings them. It's how they're greeted in the parking lot, how they're able, the ease at which they're able to get their kids into the our child care and our kids' ministries down there. There's a lot of things that happen, and I would just say this very humbly and very directly. It is high time that some of you got off the sidelines and quit being a spectator and a consumer. Because it's not all about you, all right? It's not all about you, and it's time that you say, I'm going to give something back and be a part of this ministry and not just somebody who observes it. So this is our chance to help you do that, and so I want you to make that a priority, and I want many of you to be here to help us do that, okay? All right, the seventh commandment. The seventh commandment is, thou shalt not commit adultery. So I have given the title of today's message to be, thou shalt have great sex, okay? And that is not my attempt to be God's PR manager, because he doesn't really need a PR manager. And if he did, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't choose me to do that. But I do that because the focus of this commandment, like all of the other commandments, the focus is not so much to forbid something negative. The focus is more to protect something that is positive, right? And so in behind this prohibition, thou shalt not commit adultery, there's something you can't miss, and I think people do a lot. And that is realizing that God is protecting something that is a wonderful gift that he's given to us. And that's what we're going to get in today. I was working on this message earlier this week at home. And I was in my study there at my house. And my 7-year-old daughter comes in the room. And it's up on the screen. And I'm just not paying any attention to the fact that she just walked in the room. Not even thinking about it. Until I hear her read, okay, off the screen, commandment number 7. Thou shalt have great sex. What is great sex, Daddy? That was her question to me. And I looked at her, and I know that I had that deer in the headlights look as I just stared at her, because I was thinking, I am not ready to have this conversation with you right now. And she just looks at me, and we kind of have a standoff there for a minute. And she says, sex, sex, sex. Isn't that the Latin word for six, Dad? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And what's awesome is that she was totally satisfied with that answer. She was like, oh, thou shalt have great, the number 6. And Dad's preaching on math this weekend, so that's how she understands it. So, you know what, I told that story to one of our pastors on Thursday, and he told me, he said, you know, in that moment when your daughter looked at you and said, what is great sex, Dad? He says, now you know how every parent at the Summit Church has felt at some point during one of your messages. when they looked at, their kid looked at them in the middle of the message and says, what is Pastor JD talking about right now? So that's going to be, I want you to listen very closely to this. What I'm going to talk about with you today naturally touches a subject that is somewhat mature. Now, I will tell you up front, this is a pretty tame treatment of it. Okay, it's not going to be that over the top, and so I don't really feel like it's going to be a danger, but I will tell you, if you have a kid that is in sixth grade or younger, now might be a good time, as in immediately, to get them into some of our excellent children's programming that goes on up to sixth grade. You can just stand up. You can walk them back to the back there, and there's somebody that'll meet you there in the lobby, and they'll take you to where you need to go so that we don't create some conversations that you may not be ready to have yet. Now, if you have a kid that is seventh grade or older, I promise you I'm not going to talk about anything that they have not covered thoroughly in middle school, okay? And I don't think what I'm going to say is going to be inappropriate for them, but you would have to make that judgment call yourself, okay? All right, well, there's probably no more relevant or no more unpopular command than this one, especially here in the Raleigh-Durham area. Raleigh-Durham has the highest percentage, get this, of 25 to 34-year-olds anywhere in the country. And the majority of those young professionals are single. The average marriage age for men and for women has gone all up almost 5 years in our generation. What that means is, for those of you that are somewhat near my age or younger, all right, that we are getting married 5 years later on average than our parents and our grandparents did. Now, question, what do you think single people today, why do you think they are waiting longer to get married? Do you feel like it's so they can get, you know, better prepared for marriage, they can read marriage books, memorize some verses, you know, become deft at applying the principles of Proverbs? Is that why you think they're waiting? No, it's because they're getting naked and breaking this commandment that we're going to go over, right? Right? That's what they're doing. And they don't feel like they need marriage right now to be able to participate in this, and so they don't want to mess with marriage. A recent study showed that 41% of American adults will have cohabitated at some point with somebody who is not their spouse. That is an increase of almost 72% in the last 10 years. So this command is pretty relevant, and this command is pretty countercultural. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do this morning. Firstly, I am going to review for you why God gives us these kinds of laws. You see, a lot of people have problems with any kind of commands or rules, as if rules like this kill our freedom and inhibits our ability to just be who we really are. And so we don't know why God gives these commands to us, and we resent them. So I'm going to review for you something we went over in the first week of this series, and that is why God gives us these kinds of commands. Then secondly, we're going to explain what this command actually forbids, get into some of the technicalities of the definitions here. And then thirdly, I'm going to tell you why it forbids those things, why certain kinds of sex are considered bad in the Bible. And then I'm going to show you, number four, how you can bring this area of your life underneath the blessing of God, how you can overcome sexual temptation, how you can overcome sexual addiction. And along the way, right, four things we're going to do. And along the way, I will say some humorous, slightly inappropriate things to keep your attention, okay? Just to keep it consistent. All right, here we go. Number one, why God's laws are good. Why God's laws are good. All right, there is a general assumption in our culture that rules are bad. We love freedom in this country, which is good, all right? And we think that real freedom is essential to any happiness. And true freedom, we believe, comes from throwing off any external constraints and following the dictates of our hearts, right? And I understand where that comes from, but that is built on two very deeply ingrained myths in American culture. Two things that the Bible would just flatly say are wrong assumptions, and honestly, two things that if you apply even the slightest bit of logic to them, they completely fall apart. But these are so deeply ingrained in our culture, they almost go unquestioned. Here is myth number one. We are freest when we operate independent of any rules. That's a myth. We're the freest when we operate independent of any rules. Now again, for those of you that are a part of this church and you were here when we started this series, this should be review for you. But this is a myth because you are most alive. You most thrive when you're operating according to how you are designed, not necessarily when you have cast off all restraints. The analogy I used a few weeks ago is that of a fish. Right, if a fish decides that it's tired of being constrained in the ocean and decides to hop up onto the land and exercise its freedom, that fish is not achieving freedom. That fish is going to die. You know, if you're trying to do a fish a favor and like, you know, I'm sure you feel so trapped there in the ocean, let me release you in freedom onto the land. You've not done any favors for that fish. You've just killed that fish. Because that fish is going to be freest, the most alive, it's going to thrive most when it is in the environment that God designed it to be in. Right, the way we counteract this myth is this phrase right here. That it's not a direct quote from the Bible. It's what the Bible teaches, though. And that is true freedom comes not in living by our desire. True freedom comes by living according to our design. True freedom is found not in living by desire, but in living by design. Okay? Here's the second myth as a part of our culture. Our desires, we believe, are the best way to knowing what's best for us. Our desires are the best way to determine what is best for us. Now, I'm telling you guys, from the time we are born, I mean, from the earliest kind of programming we get, from Ariel the Mermaid to Miley Cyrus to Oprah Winfrey, okay, and all throughout there, we are taught that the way to happiness is to follow our hearts. And the Bible says this is a dangerous myth, as your heart might desire a lot of bad things for you, without you even realizing that it's bad. The first week, I used several examples to show you that this assumption just is not true. One of the examples I used was what I desire to eat. My heart desires to eat a lot of fatty foods. I walk into a restaurant, there's no question about what I desire. I'm going to get a 14-ounce ribeye that's smothered in blue cheese and a side of clarified butter I can dip it in. And fries, okay, and then a dessert. You know, and I go to the doctor, and he's like, no, you cannot do that. And I'm like, but doctor, you don't understand. I got to follow my heart. I got to be true to myself. He's like, you're not following your heart. You're going to kill your heart if you do that. Right? I need you to go to the salad bar, and I need you to stuff your plate with alfalfa sprouts and garbanzo beans and all that other disgusting stuff, because that's what is going to make you alive, because you're not going to be free and thriving when you're dead. Right? So it's my desire does not necessarily lead me to a good place. Or sometimes when somebody does something to me on I-40, right, or in traffic, and they just do something rude, and we pull up to a stoplight, I'm right behind their car, my heart desires to get out of my car, go up to their window, and beat them like a rented mule. But because my heart desires that does not mean that that's what I ought to do or that's helpful in that moment. My point is that we desire all kinds of things that are harmful for us. So why would we think that our sexual desires always lead us to the place where we need to go? There's this scene in 90210. Don't ask, okay? Where one of the teenage girls in the show, I can't remember which one, she comes up to her pastor. And she says to her pastor, she's wanting to know whether or not it's okay for her to have sex with this guy that she really likes. And her pastor says to her, only your heart can tell you that. And she says, oh, and she thanks him, she gives him a hug, and she leaves, and the scene is over. You know, I expected so much more from 90210. But, you know, you watch that, and I think this, I don't mean this to be arrogant, but I'm like, you know, I could have been so much better of a screenwriter than that right there. Because what would have happened if, when he said that to her, only your heart can tell you that, if she would have looked back at him and she would have said, just follow my heart. You mean it doesn't matter how selfish or exploitive or dishonest or manipulative or immoral my heart is? I should just follow it? And then he would have said back to her, well, no, that's not really what I meant. And then she would have said, yeah, because, I mean, just follow my heart. Isn't that what Hitler did? And look where that got the world. And he would have said, well, no, that's not exactly what I meant. And then she would have said, so you mean that there are some higher moral standards that I must submit even my heart to? And the minister would have said, yeah. And then he would have been doing his job, okay? Which is to teach people that our desires are not the final verdict on what is good. The designs of the Almighty God are the final verdict on what is good. Let me ask you this. Is there a time in your life that you have followed your heart and it has gotten you into trouble? I mean to say this. I don't mean this to be insulting to you guys in high school in your early years of college, but that is a myth that high school students and college students believe, that people in their 30s are like, wait a minute, that's crazy. Because I see that my heart has desired all kinds of things that have led me astray. It's a myth that our desires lead us rightly. They don't. My point is this. God's laws are good. God's laws are freedom for us. They're not captivity. God's laws flow out of the design of a good and loving God for us. They are not the arbitrary dictates of a controlling tyrant. And so they lead to our blessing, not our misery. Okay? That's number one. That's our review of why these laws are here. Number two, what is exactly included in this commandment? What's included in this commandment? Because a lot of people have the question when they read this, they're like, okay, what exactly does this command forbid? Because the command says not to commit adultery, which is having sex with somebody who's married to somebody else. But what other kinds of sex are off limits? I mean, how far can I go with my girlfriend before I break this command? Or what about if you're engaged? Is it okay? Yeah, and what about homosexuality? Is that included in this command? Because I don't see it mentioned. Well, as I said at the beginning, listen, The underlying focus of this commandment is not on what is prohibited. The underlying focus of this commandment, get this, is on what is affirmed. This commandment is a protection of something, so we need to focus on what is being protected. Right? There's an understanding of marriage that goes back to the very first chapters of Genesis. The author of Genesis was Moses, or God through Moses. Moses also wrote Exodus. Right? And the understanding of marriage that undergirds this is that marriage is between one man and one woman who are united for life. That's what this commandment is built to protect. Now again, a lot of people sell this commandment short because they see it only in terms of the negative. Don't commit adultery. But see, behind that is a very positive command. Thou shalt have great sex. And God knows how to do that because God created sex. God created the pleasure in sex. God knows how best it works. So what kind of sex is off limits? Well, the answer is simply any sex outside of the original design, which is sex between a man and a woman united in marriage for life. Now, I'm going to explain why that is in a minute. But for right now, I just want to establish the definitions, okay? God's design for sex is one man, one woman, united in marriage for life. In the New Testament, the word for any sex outside of that kind of marriage union is porneia. Porneia, okay? Porneia is a word from which we get our word pornography, or where we get our word fornication from. Porneia is a junk drawer word in Greek. And what I mean by that is it's a word that covers everything that is outside of sex between a man and woman that are united in marriage for life. In fact, Jesus said in Matthew 5 that porneia even includes fantasizing about having sex with someone to whom you are not married. So the short answer is, if it's sexually erotic and it is outside of the union of a man and woman who are united for life, then it is porneia. Somebody says, well, you know, a teenager says, well, what about oral sex? Is that kind of sex? Was the act sexual? Okay, then yes, it is porneia. Somebody says to me, well, you know, what if we don't go all the way? You know, I mean, you know, what if we don't go all the way? Does that count as sex? Well, is what you're doing sexual? That's the question. Would you do it with your grandmother? Maybe that's an overstatement, but you get what I mean. At this point, I'm not trying to rule out harmless demonstrations of affection, but it's like I've told you before, you cross a line where you go from affection to foreplay, and you know it. And when you do, that becomes porneia a long time before the clothes come off. It's like I've told you before, you got no business lighting a rocket you do not intend to launch, right? It's just not, it's porneia. It's something before you get there because it is sexual in nature. Oh, but we really love each other. Great. Have you united in marriage? No? Then it's porneia. But we're engaged. Is engaged different from marriage? Yes, then it's porneia. You signed the contract on the house, but you haven't closed yet. So you can't move in yet, okay? We know how that works. What about friends with benefits? Quit asking stupid questions, okay? Well, what about homosexual marriage? Well, again, is that sex between one man and one woman that are united for life? Well, no, then it's considered porneia. Sometimes people say to me, well, you know, Jesus never really talked about homosexuality. He most certainly did. 11 times in the Gospels, he affirms this understanding of marriage that comes out of Genesis and Exodus. 11 times he affirms marriage as the union of a man and a woman who are united for life. So 11 times he addressed it by saying that is what God considers his design. And anything outside of that is porneia. So that is what is covered by this commandment. Number 3, why is sex outside of marriage bad? Why exactly is it bad? People understand most of the other commandments. They're like, yeah, okay, I get the not killing thing, not stealing. That makes sense. Probably shouldn't lie. I mean, I see that one. But what's wrong with two consenting, loving adults coming together in this way? And to be really honest, for a lot of people, this makes them doubt God's goodness and his wisdom. Because they think, well, my way is clearly better than that because God has arbitrary rules that don't make any sense. Here's why sex outside of marriage is bad. And that is because sex is not just biology for a human being created in the image of God. The Apostle Paul explains to us that God created us in his image, and he created marriage to point beyond itself to something divine and eternal. A lot of people recognize that, even if you're not a believer. You recognize that there is something deep and mysterious happening in sex, and that is because you are made in the image of God. Sex is not just biology. You see, rather than simply just telling us, let me go a little deeper here, okay? Rather than just telling us what he's like, what God did is in addition to giving us a list of attributes, he didn't just say, memorize these attributes and know what I'm like. He gave us things to experience in the real world that were to teach us about himself. That way, through earthly pictures, we could learn about him and the things we sense and feel in real life. Does that make sense? Well, marriage and sex is one of those. And in fact, it's one of the clearest of those. Sex is like an appetizer. It whets your appetite for something greater, something grander, something beyond itself. Which is why, by the way, in some of those places where God most clearly talks about his relationship to us, he does so in terms of a marriage. In fact, right here in Exodus, in this passage we're studying, you know, the Exodus, these commandments are given right after God's brought his people out of the land of Egypt. When God brings them out of Egypt, when he calls them to come out, it's Exodus chapter 6, if you want to know where this is. When he calls them to come out, he makes four phrases to them, which probably go right over your head. But they wouldn't do a Jewish audience. Here they are, the four phrases. I will bring you out. I will redeem you. I will rescue you. I will take you to myself to be mine. Now we hear that and we're like, oh, well, he wants to take them out. But when a Jewish audience heard those phrases, they usually catch something that we miss. Because those are the four phrases used in a Jewish marriage vow. The indication is God is calling out his bride, which is why when he gets them out to the mountain in that commandment, the first thing he says is, I'm your God, you have no other gods but me, because I'm a jealous God. In other words, I have the same jealousy for you that a husband has for his wife. Not bad jealousy, but jealous that I want your affection. You're mine and you're only mine. Something else is interesting that reading this guy, very familiar with Jewish customs, pointed out. He's like, you know, what happens is the cloud, the God's Shekinah glory is what it's called, covers them over their head, right? And so when they come out and they're standing underneath the mountain and they're making this vow, they got this glory of God above them. He said in a Jewish marriage, what happens is they take this prayer shawl that they wear around their neck, Jewish men, and they put it on these four poles. It's called a chuppah. And they put it up above you so that when you are taking your marriage vows, you're doing underneath that covering of God. So what God is doing is he's putting that chuppah up above them and saying, we're getting married. At the end of Revelation, when God finally takes us all to be with him, he invites us to the marriage supper of the Lamb. In other words, we're going into the eternal honeymoon. So the point is, earthly marriages are given to us as a picture of God's relationship with us. There are three parts of the marriage relationship that specifically mirror God's relationship with you and me. And these three things, by the way, find their ultimate expression in sex. They find their ultimate expression in a marriage in sex. Get these. First, in a marriage, there is a complete fusion of persons. Total oneness. When you get married, you stand on the altar or stand near the altar, and all of your life becomes part of their life. The good, the bad, the ugly, your future, your past, your family, your finances, everything becomes one. Right? That happened when I got married, July 28th, 2000. Everything that belonged to Veronica McPeters became mine, and everything was mine became hers. She had, you know, things that she brought to the relationship that were good. She had things that were bad. I had things that were good. I had things that were bad. We all became one. Now we are one in our finances. We're one in our futures. We're one in our families. That is accompanied by oneness in our bodies. Now, I don't mean to be too graphic here, but just follow this. In sex, your bodies interlock and literally become one. There is fusion. There is an intermingling of bodies. And here's the thing. That oneness of body is a part of a larger whole because you are one in every other area of your life too. You're one in your possessions, your futures, your families, everything. It is a fusion of bodies that goes along with a fusion of souls and a fusion of lives. All right? Here's your second thing. There is exclusivity. Exclusivity in a sexual relationship. When I got married, I told my wife, I'm going to have nobody else. I didn't tell her, you're going to go at the top of a list of girls that I have sex with. I didn't say you're going to be number one. I told her you're going to be the only one. I mean, that makes sense in sex, right? Even if you're not married and you were having sex with somebody, you don't want them out playing the field on you. I mean, girls, I mean, you know, you don't want a guy who says, yeah, baby, of all the girls that I regularly have sex with, I think you're my favorite. I mean, no, exclusivity is a part of any sexual relationship. Here's your third thing, unconditional acceptance. What is supposed to happen in marriage is you experience unconditional acceptance because somebody sees you for exactly who you are and loves you anyway. Now, I've explained to you before, again, this is review, but I've explained to you that the human quest, our desire, is to be known and loved. Known and loved. You got to have both. Because to be known but not loved is rejection. But to be loved but not really known is just sentimental. It's kind of, it's not deep at all. What we have a desire is that we really be known for who we are and loved anyway. Right? That's happening in marriage because somebody sees the real you. Now watch. That most happens in sex because in sex you're naked. And the Bible says that nakedness in the Bible is a sense of your own vulnerability and your own weakness, and you're exposed in everything that you are. And when you see someone naked, you are saying to them, I see you. I see all of you, and I accept you as you are. I love you over all your weaknesses and all your vulnerability, and I will never leave you or forsake you because I know you completely. There's nothing about you that I could see that would take away my love for you. I am yours forever. Total fusion, exclusivity, unconditional acceptance. Now, you see, those three words are three of the most descriptive words about our relationship to God. Total fusion. God completely unites himself to us. Again, it's a more intimate of a union than you could imagine. God lives inside of us. He intermingles with us. There's exclusivity. We have no other gods but him. Unconditional acceptance. God sees us for all that we are, in all of our inglorious nakedness and shame, and God loves us just as we are. Here's the point. Sex is an echo of God's love. For every human being, not just Christians, but every human being created in the image of God, sex is an echo of God's love for us. Do you get that? Because you got to see this. This that we experience down here, this sexual thing, is an echo of that. And when you get that, you start to see why sex outside of marriage is harmful. You see, we're not just animals. We're not just animals. Sex is different for us than it is for the animals. You ever watch a Discovery Channel special? I watched one the other night. Showed the mating patterns of peacocks. Why do you watch it? I don't know. Okay, but I could not turn away, right? And so, you get this peacock that struts around, spreads his tail feathers out, and dances, make noises in front of a male. The guy talking on the Discovery Channel is like, this is the mating pattern of the peacock, and this is what it does. Every animal has some version of this. Now, here's what strikes me, all right? There is no point at which the female bird asks the male, I just really need to know that you want me for more than my body. They don't fly away together somewhere and, make love, have a picnic, then cuddle and talk about how they're going to build a life and change the jungle forever, She never says to him awkwardly, I just don't like the way that you're looking at the other jungle birds, okay? You better shape up. No, it's just biology for them. That's all it is. It's a propagation of the species. It's DNA, but we're different, and you know that. Even if you're not a believer, you know that. Sex for us is different, and that's because we're made in the image of God. And when you reduce sex to just biology, or you reduce it to just a good time, or just a casual encounter, you dehumanize us. And you reduce us to the level of animals because you take the mystery and the glory that God put into us and you strip us of it. I know of a guy who is a believer now who talks about the years he spent before becoming a Christian exploiting women for sex. He said, I was a master at finding women who were in a vulnerable state or finding college-age girls who had a rocky relationship with their fathers. Right? And I would exploit them and use their vulnerability for my own pleasure. And then he made this statement. He says, I learned to hate myself because I realized that the way I was treating women not only robbed them of their humanity, it robbed me of mine as well. He said, I got to the place I couldn't even look in the mirror at myself. I hated myself because I felt like I'd become a monster. A monster is something that looks human but is not human. That's what he's saying was happening. And I think it's very insightful. When you have sex outside of the confines of total oneness, it is monstrous because you are separating the humanity that God put into us in his image from sex. People think the Bible has too low a view of sex. They're like, oh, the Bible needs to loosen up and realize how awesome sex is. It's actually exactly the opposite. The Bible has an extremely high view of sex. It realizes there is something beautiful and mysterious going on during sex that literally puts you in touch with deity. And when you make it about just biology, you dehumanize us. You dehumanize us. Sex touches the most intimate, personal, vulnerable parts of our bodies. It exposes us in the most open of ways. Our lover who touches us in these intimate places is caressing not only the most intimate parts of our bodies, but in so doing is caressing the intimate parts of our souls. So of course it should be done only in a relationship where you are one in every possible way for life. It's interesting to me to see even people who don't believe in any kind of God begin to recognize this. There's a book that came out a few years ago called The End of Sex, written by one of the senior editors of Look magazine. Now, you may not recognize that because it's not a super popular magazine anymore. But Look magazine back in the 60s was one of the most popular magazines in America, and it championed this whole sexual liberation. This guy was the editor of it. Okay, so this guy was a major proponent in the sexual liberation movement in our country in the 60s. He came out many years later with a book he called The End of Sex, in which he says, and I quote, "Listen, I know and I see now that every game has its rules. I was myself a proponent of sexual liberation, but now I see that sex itself has rules. And unless you play by the rules, sex can create a depth of loneliness like nothing else can." Some of you know exactly what he's talking about. Unless you play by God's rules, it can create a depth of loneliness and despair in you like nothing else can. So many of you resist this commandment because you're afraid that you're missing out on something. The Bible tells you what it tells you about sex precisely because it doesn't want you to miss out on something. Listen, can I play daddy for a minute? I'm going to, okay? I went around to our staff some of our staff this week, just in a brainstorming session, and I asked them to tell me about the first time that their parents talked to them about sex. Some of the most awful stories I've ever heard came out of that conversation. And I'm looking at our pastoral team. Many of these people come out of good families. We're not talking about wildly dysfunctional families. We're talking about decent families. And their parents just never talked to them about it. Right? Which means that in our church, there's a lot of you that your parents never talked to you about it. Right? And I can't play your real daddy, but I can, you know, be something like that for just a minute here, okay? So let me play daddy. Especially, I got like maybe a soft spot for you girls because I have three daughters, and so let me especially talk to you girls for a minute. Okay, listen. You were created in the image of God. What God gave you in your sexuality is a precious gift that He designed for you to give away to a guy who deserves it. And by that, I mean a guy who will commit to you body and soul for the rest of your life. That's what He designed for you to do. He gave you that gift. It is precious. He wants you to give it to a guy that deserves it, not some thug in college who's trying to use you to satisfy a sexual urge. You see, when a guy has sex with a girl, when a guy has sex with you and doesn't marry you, he is treating you the way a bulimic treats food. A bulimic loves the taste of food, and so they take food into their body, but they don't want all the calories with that food, so they regurgitate it, they vomit it back up. And what that guy is doing is he is tasting oneness with you, and he likes it. He likes the taste of that oneness. But he doesn't want you. He doesn't want you. So he regurgitates you back up by not giving you himself for life. That's why I always told girls when I was a youth pastor in my youth group, never believe anything a guy says after 8 p.m. Because if he doesn't say it before 8 p.m., he doesn't mean it. You're like, oh, no, 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 but he loves me. He really does. I know that he loves me. If he really loves you, he will guard your purity and he'll be willing to wait for marriage. Let me make this perfectly clear, okay? The problem with that guy that you're sitting next to right now who is sleeping with you before marrying you, the problem is he does not love you even enough to put your purity and your good above his sexual urges. And you need to look at him as soon as this message is over and say, get out of my life, you selfish jerk. Is that a little harsh? Might have been. Okay, what's next? Maybe he didn't know. I mean, honestly, Maybe you didn't know. Maybe you've been living in ignorance, and now that I'm explaining to you what it says, now you're living in light of knowledge you previously did not have. So, yes, be gracious. But I'm just saying that there are some things that God gives us out of love for us. You are precious, and you need to preserve that because that is God's design for you. And many of you resist this commandment because you're so afraid you're missing out on something. And I'm telling you, God gave this commandment precisely because he doesn't want you to miss out on something. So that's why sex outside of marriage is considered to be bad. And that's why this commandment is there. But before we're finished with this commandment, okay, I need to go one step farther with this, and I've got to show you what is happening in your heart with this commandment. We've got to take it down to your heart level. Okay, you see, Jesus said that this thing, sex, is so sacred, it is so holy, and it so closely relates to the depths of our hearts and our relationship to God that we should not even entertain thoughts about sex outside of marriage. Matthew chapter 5, let me walk you through this passage where Jesus reinterprets this commandment. Matthew 5, verse 27. These are probably three of my least favorite verses in the whole Bible. Okay, I'm just going to throw that out there. Verse 27, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everybody who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body get thrown into hell. Y'all, as a college kid, these verses almost drove me to despair. Because saying don't lust after women would be like saying to me, don't breathe. And I was like, I can't not do that. And then you mix in that part about going to hell. And then Jesus drops the stuff about cutting stuff off. I was like, seriously? I mean, if we apply this verse just as it's written, every guy in here would be blind within a matter of minutes. Right? I mean, a girl walks into our church, as they frequently do, wearing one of those outfits that look like they melted onto themselves about an hour before. Right? Or wearing skinny jeans, which I otherwise like to refer to as ankle-length panties. Okay? So. Oh, yeah. Okay. They come in here and they're walking down this aisle. We're applying this verse literally. You're hearing like all these eyeballs plopping on the ground, rolling down the thing. I'm like, how do you apply that? Plus, listen, I mean, blind people are fully capable of lusting too. So how is popping out our eyeballs fix this problem? All right, so first, let me go over a few things here. First, it's not saying don't desire. Not even saying don't look with great anticipation. It's saying don't mentally go through the sex act with somebody who's not your spouse. Second, this is very serious. Jesus did not do exaggeration for theatric effect. He's very serious. But here is what he's getting at. Sex, watch, has a way of taking over our lives. Sexual desire has a way of taking over our lives. It very quickly becomes a god to us. Sexual desire very quickly becomes an idol. Remember, we define an idol as whatever you delight in most, whatever you feel like you need most. Whatever you say, I couldn't be happy without that. Or something that you obey most, whatever commands your obedience. For many people, sex has become that thing. For many, romantic love and sex is what they feel like they could not be without. And so they're willing to do anything to get it. A girl is willing to give her body away to get the attention of a guy. Or she's willing to leave her marriage or her kids to get romance that she's not getting in her marriage. For many, sex is beauty, right? It's beauty. And so what a guy does is he takes it to himself. He's like, I've got to sleep with these girls because this is a way of bringing beauty into my life. It's a way of capturing beauty. He may not ever verbalize it like that, but that's what he's doing. You know, for girls, it's usually the opposite. It's not that they need to take beauty. It's that they want to be themselves beautiful. So they're willing to, well, first of all, they obsess about how their body looks. And they work out insanely. Right? Then they get jealous of anybody who looks better than they do, and they get devastated if you ever make a comment that implies that they don't look as good as they want to look. Right? And then they're willing to do anything with a guy who will treat them like they're beautiful. And the guy learns that, and he starts to exploit that because they have this weakness. They want to be beautiful because sex is beauty to them, and it is desire. They want to be beautiful. It's a god to them. For many, sex is the thing that commands their obedience. So a guy can't quit looking at internet porn. Sex calls to him, and he answers. It commands his obedience. Sex has become a god. And as Jesus says, it all starts in the desires of the heart, because that's where idolatry is. That's why the stuff about hell. Because sexual desire left unchecked gradually consumes your heart and commands your obedience to the point that it becomes more of a god to you than God himself is. Some of you are there right now. I mean, you say that you're committed to God. You say that you're a Christian. You're even in seminary. But guys, let's be honest. When sex calls, you answer. You give some surface level regret after engaging in that sexual release, but never a real repentance that says, God, I desire you more than I desire this, and I want to obey you more than I want to obey this. Some of you are in the midst of an immoral relationship you know you should not be in, but you will not get out of it, or you can't get out of it. Why? Because it is a god to you. You feel like you can't live without it. Some of you are thinking about leaving your marriage. You know that the Bible teaches that divorce is wrong unless a very specific set of criteria are met. But you feel like you have to have real sexual love and intimacy. You can't live without that. It's your god. So you rationalize it. And some of you, maybe you'll never be brave enough to leave your relationship. You'll just stay in a marriage where you're unhappy. But it's a god to you. It's why you are always fantasizing about leaving your marriage or fantasizing about your spouse's premature death. I know girls that read romance, trashy romance novels and watch all these movies and vicariously try to participate in the stories of the women in these things, in these stories, because they're trying to leave their story and get involved in this one because that's what would make them happy. Sex is your god. That's why Jesus says the things he does about hell here. Listen, God does not send you to hell for struggling with sin. I still struggle with sin. I still struggle with lust. He sends you to hell for deliberately submitting yourself to another god besides him. To that point where you say, this is what I can't live without. This is what commands my obedience. This is what I live for. So you need to ask yourself honestly right now, what is your god? What commands your obedience? What commands your obedience this morning? If you realize sex and romantic love have displaced God, then what does Jesus tell you to do? Radically, radically go to war against it. Practically speaking, that means cutting off your hand, which is a metaphor for cutting out anything that provokes you to it, right? I mean, think about it. He wouldn't say cut off your hand because someone without a hand can still lust. He's saying cut out the things of your life that keep you in the midst of this, which for some of you means removing the internet out of your house. It means getting involved in one of what we call our freedom groups here, which are groups which get together to try to encourage each other and to try to find self-discipline and try to release themselves from these temptations. For some of you, it means breaking up with the guy. That's what it means to cut off your hand. Because you can't say no, and it's too much of a weakness. You need to walk out and get away. All right? But listen, those external changes, plucking out your eye, cutting off your hand, those will only go so far because blind, armless people lust too. All right? So what you really need to do, what Jesus is teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, is you really need to return to the first commandment. It's because your soul is not right with God that you crave all those things in sex. Remember, sex is a picture. It's a shadow. It's wonderful, yes, but it points beyond itself to the love of God that's given to us in Jesus. You see, in Jesus, we see total fusion as he took upon himself our sin, and he united himself with us, and he intermingles with us, and he comes to live inside of us. He took our sin and died with it. He gave us his righteousness and his goodness. We see real total fusion. In him, we see unconditional acceptance because he saw the nakedness of our souls. He looked in it, and he loved us entirely. In him, we feel that unconditional, never stopping, never giving up love that loves us in our faults and nakedness. What we crave in sex, we find in Jesus. There's only one kiss. There's only one set of arms that can fulfill your deepest heart needs. Jesus is ultimate beauty. Jesus is the intimacy that your soul craves. And here's the thing. When you find him, then you start to have power to say no to the other. It's not that you still don't desire those things anymore. It's just that they don't control you and dominate you like they used to. In other words, girls, you quit being so dependent on and dominated by guys. And you start to be healthy enough to make wise choices. This phrase we use around here goes like this. You're not ready to date until you're ready not to date. You're not ready to date until you're ready not to date. What I mean by that is, some of you feel like you have to date because unless you date, you couldn't be happy. Unless you're married, you couldn't be happy. There's no way you could be happy being single. That means you need to date. That means you're not ready to date. Because that means you're going to turn whoever you date into an idol and you're going to destroy both him and you. But when you're ready not to date, at that point you're ready to date because now you are complete in Christ and now you can love somebody out of the overflow of your heart and not out of a desperate sense of codependency. You're not ready to date until you're ready not to date. Guys, for you, that means that when you're filled with the largeness and the majesty of God's presence, then you'll be able to control your desires. You want to know how you can control your desires? A lot of guys are just in despair about, how do I say no to these things? An old Puritan by the name of Thomas Chalmers, who used a phrase that I love. He called it the expulsive power of a new affection. And what he means is that lesser desires are controlled by displacing them with a larger desire. Does that make sense? I used this example a few weeks ago. This should be review, but let me kind of make sure. I said to guys, I say this all the time to college guys, you could control your sexual urges at will, and you can turn them on and off like a light switch. And remember, I explained to you that when I say that, guys look at me and they shake their head and are like, what's wrong with you? What happens to you when you turn 35? Do you forget what it's like to be a guy? There's no possible way I could ever turn my sexual desires on and off like a light switch. Right? And I don't know what it's like to turn 35 because I haven't done that yet. Okay? All right? So, yes, I have. I'm like, no, you can turn them on and off like a light switch. I'll prove it to you. And here's the example I always use. Okay? So, you're with this girl. She's totally hot. You're completely into her. You're making out. You're at her house on her couch all alone. Right? You're however you term it now, first base, second base, third, I don't know what y'all say anymore. But you round whatever base it is that you pass what we used to call in college the point of no return. At that point, I mean, the locomotive is in high gear. There ain't no turning back. You are at the point of no return. No turning it off. Right? There's no way to say no to that temptation. In walks that girl's, all of a sudden, Army Ranger father with a shotgun. Bam! Off like a light switch. Okay? No more sexual desire. Now, what happened in that moment that you lost? Is it that you lost your sexuality? You might be about to, okay, but you didn't lose your sexual desire, right? What happened is it was displaced by a larger desire. All right, let me go back to math class. Your desire for her body is less than your fear of her father. And the point is, when God's presence is as large to you as that girl's father was in that moment, at that point you have the ability to say no to the lesser urges. You see, the answer for you is not to sit around and just try to drum up self-control and cut off your hands and pop out all your eyes. The answer is for God to become God in your life. When he does, the expulsive power of a new affection drives out the lesser ones. Now, last thing here. Some of you, I've listened this whole time, but I have blown it. This would all have been great if I'd heard this and listened to this when I was 12 years old, but I didn't. And I made more mistakes than I could ever tell you. So let me close by taking you to my favorite place in all the Bible where it talks about sex. And that is a very short conversation Jesus had with a woman who had made more mistakes than probably any of you ever could. There was a woman who was so sexually loose that she had sex with other men's husbands without regret. And she was caught by the men in her city in the very act of adultery. And in John 8, she is dragged before city council, all the people in the city, humiliated. She's partly naked because she was taken in the very act of adultery. If you're familiar with the Bible, you know the story. Jesus says, let him who is without sin cast first stone. Nobody does it. She's there with him by himself. And he makes a statement to her that is so profound that we usually miss it. He says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. What's always intriguing to me is the order he put those two things. Because we almost always reverse that order. We're always like, if you don't go and sin no more, then I won't condemn you. And God says, no. Acceptance and forgiveness comes first. Change comes second. Because it is my acceptance of you and my forgiveness of you that washes you of your sin and changes you and makes you a new creation that gives you the capacity to change. What am I telling you? I'm telling you that Christ has the capacity to forgive you and make you a new creature, to make you holy and pure in His sight, and out of that position that He gives you, then you begin to behave differently. You don't change your behavior and then change your status before God. You change your status before God and then change your behavior. You're not going to be pure because you're a virgin, okay? God's going to make you a virgin in His sight by washing you in the blood of Jesus, which can make you more pure than physical virginity ever could. And then out of that purity, then you become sexually healthy again. The answer to sexual health, or the problem of sexual health, is not solved by a perfect record, and it's not solved by new resolutions. It's solved by the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when you accept what Christ has done for you and what He can make you, that'll change you. You understand that? Thou shalt have great sex. That command flows out of what God has done for us and what He's made us in Himself. That's where we find the capacity to obey that command. Why don't you bow your heads if you would? With your heads bowed and eyes closed, at all of our campuses, let me ask you this. How do you see yourself? How do you see yourself? Have you ever received what Christ has done for you, what He's offered to you? You let Him clean you and make you whole? Have you received Him as your Savior? That's the path to sexual healthiness. That's the path to good sex and marriage. With your heads bowed and eyes closed, let me tell you a true story. I want you to keep your eyes closed because I want you just to think through this. I know the true story of a guy and a girl who were engaged to one another. They got married. She had an affair on him while they were engaged and continued that affair on a year or two after they got married. Eventually, she broke it off, but she never told her husband what she had done. 10-15 years go by, and she is living with this secret. She's been unfaithful to him at the beginning of their marriage. Finally, she knows, because she sees problems in their relationship. She senses her emotional distance from him. Senses the problems, and she's like, I've got to come clean. And so she, terrified, sits him down and confesses to him what she's done. Just afraid he's going to walk out and never come back, which is exactly what he did. Without saying a word, he got up. He left. She thought he was leaving forever. He disappeared for 2 or 3 hours, and he came back. Walked back into the house, didn't say a word to her, grabbed her by the hand, took her to their bedroom, completely undressed her, and then took out of this bag that he was carrying a brand new silk white nightgown, put it on her, and said, I choose to see you. Oh, Jesus. The healing for you sexually starts with seeing yourself and seeing your spouse as Jesus sees you. Can you embrace that white garment of purity right now? Believe it and embrace it and take it on. Father, I pray that we would believe the gospel this morning. We pray in Jesus' name.